Welcome to Consilience, an African science podcast, brought to you from Johannesburg, South Africa. Consilience is a weekly podcast dedicated to promoting reason, skepticism, and a scientific worldview in Africa and beyond.
Welcome to Consilience. Today is April 30th, 2011, and I'm Owen Swart. Joining me today are Michael Meaden.
Hello.
And Angela Meaden.
Hello, everyone.
All right, let's start with teaching Angela to appreciate history.
This week, the burden falls to me again. And on April 30th, 1006, something fantastic appeared in the sky. A guest star that was so bright that you could probably have read a book by it at night. We now know this guest star was supernova SN 1006, and modern estimates put its apparent magnitude, a measure of its brightness, at minus 7.5. For comparison, the sun is minus 26.7, and the moon at its brightest is minus 12.5. So it was extremely bright. And a supernova is essentially an exploding star. And these explosions can be so energetic that for brief periods they can outshine entire galaxies. SN 1006 was observed in Switzerland, Japan, Iraq, China, Japan, and possibly even North America, if we've interpreted some rock art properly. The remnant is now known to be about 7,200 light years away in the constellation Lupus. And supernovas, or the history of human beings looking and observing supernovas, is actually quite important, because although SN 1006 didn't play a direct role, for a very long time the predominant view of the universe was the Aristotelian one. And on that view, everything above the moon or the superluminary sphere was unchanging and uncorruptible. On this view of the universe that became dominant a little bit later than 1006, when the Catholic Church got hold of it and Dante's theory of the moral universe was plastered on top of Aristotle, the idea was that everything in the sky, all the celestial objects, were perfect, unchanging, they moved in perfect circles for all eternity, and they were made of a special kind of matter called quintessence. And that's above and beyond the normal fire, earth, water, and air that made up everything below the moon, or the sublunary sphere. So the existence of supernovas challenged this view that the sky was unchanging and perfect. And around 500 years later, supernova SN 1572, known as Tycho's nova, after Tycho Brahe, the early astronomer, played an important role in the overthrow of the Aristotelian / Dantean view of the universe that was dominant at the time, and it was replaced by the modern scientific view, the Copernican Revolution.
Right, so the Aristotelian model, Aristotelian means of Aristotle, the Greek philosopher. Whether or not he actually came up with it is, I imagine, in question.
No, it's pretty clear he came up with most of it.
It's not just attributed to him.
No, he's very well documented. It's not like Socrates, for example, who never wrote his own stuff down, and he's only known through Plato. Aristotle was actually a very well-known figure, and he wrote a lot of books. And although there are some works attributed to him that were not written by him, it's fairly well known that his physics was his work. Not everything, of course, was his originally, as in he came up with it originally. It's his.
Okay. So his model suggested that the universe consisted of a bunch of spheres, one inside the other. The moon had its own sphere, and the sun had its own sphere, and the planets each had their own sphere, and then the outer sphere was the stars, and then that was vast and unchanging. Okay, so the supernovae, nova, of course, is Latin for new, as in new star. So that led us to challenge that model. That's awesome.
Moving on to some listener feedback. You may recall from last week we had a Karoo monster, and now the plot has thickened. I believe Angela's going to tell us about that.
Yes. Let me add something material to this podcast today. So last week we discussed the Statlerville monster, which was a very brief report of someone who saw a creature in the night in the dark, which seemed to change shapes between a man and a pig and a bat before disappearing. So we've had a follow-up of a few more sightings of this shape-shifting creature. In the same town, it was reported that two men at a tavern walked up to a man wearing a black jacket, and after challenging him, discovered he had no head. And then this headless man apparently changed into a very angry dog that was as big as a cow. I mean, the story is incredibly complicated and it's full of strange twists and turns. But basically,
I think incredible is the word we're looking for there. Yeah. In many senses of the word.
Yeah, this is literally unbelievable. But what we've got is more complicated stories of the sighting of this monster by more people, and yet still no evidence, no proof that it exists beyond the tall tales that are coming out of a Karoo town, and the monster's only seen around a tavern at night.
That's an interesting correlation. Also, one minor point is we came down heavily on News24 for being the news source that broke the story, but I now see that other news agencies have picked up on the story, including Eyewitness News and The Independent Online, which is disappointing from one of those sources.
Mm. Well, we don't have very much more to say about that. If you want a bit more background, listen to last week's episode. It's just typical for these stories to evolve and, you know, more details to be added, usually even more incredible. And my prediction is this will run its course and nothing will come of it.
The monster has been given a name now.
It's Baba Kozi, meaning brother-in-law in, I'm not sure which language.
Not really sure what that means. But
yeah, why brother-in-law? I have no idea.
Yeah, I think we're just seeing the birth throes of a meme.
Yeah, possibly.
All right, our second listener feedback or correction is last week I used a term ambiguously, and the term I used was hominin, and in my description I wasn't anywhere near as precise as I should have been, and I think it's deserving of some clarification. The word I probably should have used was hominin, but I'll let Mike explain the difference to us.
Yeah, so the terms relating to the different groups of human beings and the other great apes have changed quite a bit in the last 20 years or so. So the word hominid used to mean the human side of the great ape family, but that's no longer the usage. Hominid now means all of the great apes. So it's us, chimps, bonobos, gorillas, and orangutans, including all our extinct ancestors and cousins. So an Australopithecus would be a hominid, as would a gorilla ancestor that lived 8 million years ago, and everything else. So the term we now use for the, as it were, the human side of the family, so the animals, the creatures that are more closely related to human beings than they are to chimps or bonobos, is hominan. And while keeping all these names straight is quite difficult, it is nonetheless, I think, important to be as accurate as possible. And if we do make mistakes like this, please let us know. I will link to in the show notes to a Wikipedia article that lists the superfamily, family, subfamily, tribe, and genus of all the humans and the other great apes quite nicely, so you can visualize exactly how all the different groups are related to each other. But the basic takeaway is what used to be used as hominid is now hominan, which is the branch of the great ape family we are part of.
Now hominin, that, which is the word I use, that ends in IN, that refers to the chimpanzee family, as it were. So that's humans and chimpanzees and bonobos and all of our related cousins, and that's that
sure.
Yeah. Okay, cool. All right, so I'll try and remember that next time. This isn't the first time Michael has corrected me on this point. I should add.
I make a habit of correcting people about tiny mistakes and then ignoring everybody else who corrects me with tiny mistakes. I'm just angry. Moving on to the news. Owen, tell us about Adcock Ingram and painkillers.
Right. Well, following on from last week where we spoke about vaccinations, and specifically we spoke about Big Pharma, and we mentioned how pharmaceutical companies are strictly regulated by the government, this story illustrates exactly that at work. Now, for some time, there has been a medical intervention available called dextropropoxifene, or DPP for short, which is an analgesic, that is to say, it's a painkiller. It's been available commercially in a bunch of different drugs, some of which manufactured by Adcock Ingram.
In South Africa,
yes. So it's been available around the world quite a while. Now, this drug has now been withdrawn by Adcock Ingram after the Medicines Control Council of South Africa, the MCC, cancelled the registration of DPP because it has been found that DPP's risks outweigh the benefits. Now, this is exactly what we were talking about before. Once a drug has gone through clinical trials and large-scale trials and that sort of thing, it goes onto the open market, and data continues to be collected indefinitely. And as more data comes in, what might have been a subtle effect that would have been missed in early trials becomes apparent when you go from thousands of people who are taking it now to millions of people who are taking it. You can now see these effects, and that's what's happened here. This drug, DPP, it turns out, is, while it may be effective as a painkiller, it also has significant risk, and the MCC has followed the FDA's suit in deregistering the drug. It's no longer commercially available.
While it is true that this is a case of the self-correcting nature of scientific medicine, you shouldn't think that we're full of praise for the regulators in this specific instance, because this drug has been on the market since the 1950s, and it was withdrawn in Europe and I think in the UK in 2005 because of increased suicides, and it was withdrawn in the United States in November last year, and South Africa is behind the ball, it seems to me. While it's obviously quite important to take an evidence-based approach, to be careful and so on, it seems to me that in this specific case that the regulators made a mistake. They erred on the side of keeping the drug on the market until it was shown to be harmful, instead of the correct way of going about it, in my opinion, is to err on the side of banning it until it is shown to be safe and effective. But these kinds of things are a balancing act, as Owen pointed out just now and also at length last week. If any drug has both risks and benefits, and where exactly you draw the line is often quite hard to establish. And the same kind of thing happened with Vioxx in the United States a couple of years ago. In very small number of people resulted in some negative side effects that wasn't picked up in the clinical trials because they didn't have the statistical power to pick up very small effects. So the smaller any effect is in a study, the larger the number of participants you need to be able to detect that effect. That's a measure of statistical power. And of course, we don't have infinite amount of money, so we can't have millions of people in clinical trials. We usually have several thousands or tens of thousands of people in clinical trials. But as I said, this at least it has now happened, and it is an example of how drugs ought to be regulated, even if in this case perhaps it was a bit slow, especially for South Africa. But it's the hallmark of science that you change your mind if the evidence changes. And this is what has happened here. The evidence has come out, the drug is too harmful given the benefits it has, and therefore it's been removed.
The story's not over yet. Adcock Ingram is contesting this order. They are still selling the product. They're just including a lot of customer information in the product container when they sell it. And they claim that independent data has shown that none of the products in South Africa which contain DPP have led to any increase in heart-related condition in South Africa.
Quite right. If you as a consumer would like to steer clear of some of these products, three of Adcock's products specifically are called Synap Forte, Lentogesic, and Doxafene. But, you know, whether or not you'd like to avoid those products is up to you, I suppose, but it's perhaps worth knowing.
Well, I had Synap Forte after an operation, and it is great as a painkiller, but now that I know, I would probably ask my doctor to prescribe something else in future.
Indeed.
Sure, the fact that there are so many alternatives makes this decision far easier. If this was the only effective analgesic we had available and it had some negative consequences, then its use would probably be more justified. But given that there are so many different painkillers on the market, and powerful ones to boot. In fact, there's a researcher quoted in an article we'll link to who says this is the worst drug in history. we'll see how this pans out, and we'll keep our eyes on it. But for now, it's probably a good idea to avoid the product.
It should also be noted that the product hasn't yet been banned in places like Australia and France. So although some countries have decided to get rid of it, not everybody has. You know, take that as you will.
All right, so moving on. Bit of bad astronomy news, and not in the sense of full plate bad astronomy, but astronomy news that is sad.
Wow, Mike. Smooth.
I know. What can I say? So SETI, it seems, has run out of money, at least in part. So the Allen Telescope Array has been forced offline, and it's been put into a state of hibernation. The array was originally planned to consist of 350 interlinked antennas, but it has had persistent funding problems. It has never actually been completed. Its main funder has been Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen, which is why it's called the Allen Telescope Array. And the array is very much like the SKA that we have been talking about, but instead of being a square kilometer, it would have been a hectare big, and it would also have been a radio interferometer. But unfortunately, the Allen Telescope Array has been a joint project between SETI and University of California, Berkeley, and Berkeley's National Science Foundation grant has been cut to about a tenth of its previous level. And in addition to that, the state of California, as you may know, has had serious budget problems. Its budget is a bit foobar, and so it doesn't have the money to fund this Allen Telescope Array. And this is the time is especially bad because the Kepler Space Telescope, which we have mentioned in previous episodes, is in the process of releasing quite a bit of data that SETI was planning to use to further the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. What Kepler does is it uses a method of finding stars where a planet passes in front of a star, the light that reaches the telescope dims slightly, and if you see that a number of times, at least three times, you can infer that a planet is orbiting that star. What SETI was planning to do is they were going to look at these planet candidates and analyze them with the Allen Telescope Array and look for radio communications from these exoplanets that Kepler had found, but now those plans have fallen through. So, if you have any spare cash, I suggest you go to SETI.org, SETI.org, and donate some money. I'm sure every penny helps, and hopefully SETI will get more funding from other organizations as well. Famously, the SETI Institute was created after the U.S. Senate voted in the mid-early 90s, I think, to essentially cut funding for the what was caricatured at the time as the search for little green men, by rather unscientific Congress people, I believe they were. But hopefully they can get some more funding and continue the search for life elsewhere in the universe. And let's not forget that this, if we are successful, this will be the biggest scientific finding ever. So using a small amount of money, even if the probability of finding life is very low, it's low probability, high yield research that deserves at least some funding. And if you have any spare cash, I suggest you donate some of it.
Right. So to be clear, this isn't all SETI everywhere. This is only two of the larger SETI programs that are experiencing this issue. The SETI Institute, as Michael mentioned, is sort of descended from the U.S. government's SETI program. And UC Berkeley, you may be familiar with if you've ever used the SETI at Home screensaver project. And that's one of their initiatives. But just because the Allen Array is offline doesn't mean that they're not still doing SETI work. They're still able to hire telescope time on countless other radio observatories around the world. The nice thing about the Allen Array was that it was a radio interferometer that was going to be dedicated specifically to SETI work, that wasn't going to be used for other astronomy. Well, obviously they would still be drawing the data for other astronomers would be able to use, but it was specifically intended for SETI work. Mm. And of course, as I understand it, they're still soliciting donations. If you have a few thousand dollars lying around, you can pay for the construction of your very own dish as part of the Allen Array. I'm sure they would be more than happy to accept your donation. And of course, if you are interested in learning about the goings-on at the SETI Institute, I recommend the SETI's Week podcast, Are We Alone? We'll link to that in the show notes.
From the end of one era to the beginning of another, there is some interesting research going on regarding how people respond to long periods of time in very small spaces, which could be applied to interplanetary travel or long time spent on the International Space Station, for example. A social psychologist called Gro Sandeloff at the University of Bergen in Norway has discovered that creative thinking is not jeopardized by spending long periods of time with the same small group people. This is, of course, a possible danger which could be faced by astronauts on extended missions. So, six cosmonauts spent 105 days in a replica spacecraft to simulate a long mission as part of the Mars 500 project. So, Sandeloff, what he did is before these six cosmonauts entered the spaceship, he asked them to complete a questionnaire which would measure specific sort of human behavior and thinking patterns to see how you would react emotionally to difficult circumstances. And the six guys climbed into the replica spaceship and obviously spent the 105 days aboard. A little bit of interesting information about it is that the chamber is designed to mimic the space station as close as you can possibly do so while still on Earth and bound to our gravity. So the humidity and the temperature and the pressure and the gas composition of the ISS is the same as what's inside of this capsule. Each crew member has his own tiny sleeping quarters, plus a shared living room, kitchen, and workspace with medical equipment. Cosmonauts were kept to a strict schedule of eating, exercising, and performing or participating in scientific experiments. And then at specific intervals throughout the 105 days, they were then questioned again with the same questionnaire to see how their thinking might change, because the worry is that they will start to think in lockstep, something called groupthink. It's what is thought to happen when a small group of people are isolated, for instance, under highly stressful conditions like a shipwreck at sea or something.
The groupthink concept was first introduced by the social psychologist Irving Janis in 1972. He has a book which is very good called Victims of Groupthink, in which he argues the only way to understand a lot of happenings in the world is through groupthink. He argued that the Bay of Pigs invasion in the early 1960s, 1962 I think it was, where a small number of American-trained Cuban exiles were landed in Cuba trying to overthrow the communist government there run by Fidel Castro, as an example of groupthink. The deliberations prior to the decision to go ahead with the mission were deeply flawed, according to Janis, and showed all the signs of people not questioning the basic premises of their view of the world. I've always found interesting as they landed a few hundred individuals, these Cuban exiles, who weren't soldiers, they were just guys that just trained up a little bit, and with no heavy equipment, no air support, no nothing, and they were outnumbered 1,000 to 1 by the Cuban army, which had tanks and artillery, and somehow the Kennedy administration convinced itself that this plan was a good idea. it really is a deep mystery why the Kennedy the plan was originated under the Eisenhower administration, and it was apparently Richard Nixon's baby, who was Eisenhower's vice president at the time. Janis essentially invoked groupthink as an explanation for why the hell did the Kennedy administration go ahead with this deeply idiotic mission. Among other things, I read this book probably a decade ago or so I can't remember the rest of the examples he used, but that is one of the most memorable. And it is controversial, as Angela has said, because it's unclear whether it actually exists or not. But be that as it may, it's quite a fascinating topic nonetheless.
The questionnaires that Sandel ran revealed no indications of groupthink. In fact, he said that they saw that interpersonal differences within the crew became more salient as a source of tension as time passed. So the longer they spent, the more their differences started to come out.
To be honest, I haven't read the paper associated with the story. I just looked at the Wire article that Angela found, and I have rather serious doubts about this particular article, is because the researchers took a measure of personal values and then measured whether the individuals had more similar values. And this is from the Wire article, so if it's incorrect, you know, yell at Wire. But it appears that they did a before and after comparison whether their values were more closely related to each other after the mission than before the mission. But that's not the heart of groupthink. The groupthink is a decision-making process, not in terms of values. So I'm not entirely convinced this study really addresses groupthink, but I can't really say much more before I've actually read the actual article.
Okay, our next story today is about a new antimatter detector. That is an instrument that is going to be launched on Endeavour's final mission, the Space Shuttle Endeavour, which should be launching any day now. It was supposed to have gone up during the royal wedding yesterday, but didn't.
Wedding? What?
Apparently there was some wedding, I don't know.
What? Sacrifice of the virgins.
Yeah, that's what I thought. It's been delayed a couple of days. It'll probably be going up on Monday as we're speaking now. And this instrument is called an Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer, or an AMS. Now, this is generally regarded as being the International Space Station's most important scientific instrument to date, because this instrument will be affixed to the International Space Station. But let's just talk about what it's for. What does it do? So this instrument is basically a cylindrical magnet. And what it does is it detects antimatter nuclei and positrons. Okay, so let's explain what those things are. Now, you have matter, right? Just about all of the stuff that we're familiar with is made out of matter. Now, matter is made out of atoms, and those atoms are made out of a positively charged nucleus and a negatively charged electron around it. Okay, that's high school science. Now, antimatter is kind of the same as matter, except the opposite. So it also is made up of atoms or antiatoms, but the difference is that the nucleus of an antiatom is negatively charged, and it's surrounded by positively charged electrons, which are called positrons. So that's an antiatom, which is an atom or antimatter. Now, when matter and antimatter come into contact with each other, they annihilate. Basically, all of the charges cancel each other out, and the two particles fall apart, and all you get is a burst of radiation, a huge burst of radiation. If you're familiar with Star Trek, you'll know that this is the reaction that powers the warp drive, because it's the most efficient source of energy we've been able to come across so far. Right, but in the universe, for some reason, there seems to be an asymmetry. That is, that for some reason, all of the stuff we can see, as far as we can tell, is made up of matter, not antimatter. Now, at the beginning of the universe, the Big Bang, there should have been the same amounts of matter and antimatter forming, but for some reason there wasn't. There's slightly more matter than antimatter, so all of that stuff cancelled itself out, and then the 1% of, or the 0.00001% differential, that is all the stuff that we see in the universe today, apparently. But that doesn't mean that there isn't still some antimatter around. In fact, a few years ago, an instrument called PAMELA, which is the Payload for Antimatter, Matter Exploration, and Light Nuclei Astrophysics.
Very clever.
We'll just call it PAMELA. detected signs of what seemed to be an antimatter halo around the Milky Way galaxy. So that's the galaxy we live in. And it seems like around the disk of the galaxy, there is a region of space where antimatter is being produced and annihilated. So it's coming into contact with regular matter and exploding. So PAMELA detected some signs of that. So this instrument is many times more sensitive than PAMELA, and will hopefully get some more precise readings of what's happening there. Now, the reason it has to happen in space is because Earth's atmosphere is opaque to this kind of radiation. This radiation, when it arrives at Earth, is called cosmic rays and forms part of a vast spectrum of different kinds of particles and radiation that's coming at us from all kinds of sources all over the galaxy. But scientists know how to differentiate the kind of radiation that comes from matter-antimatter annihilation, because it looks different, right? So this instrument is designed to detect only that kind of radiation, and it has to be in space, which is why it has to be stuck to the ISS. The nice thing is that it can be stuck to the ISS. It doesn't have to be in its own orbit like the Hubble Space Telescope or those other observatories, which means that it's that much easier to service in the future. But what they're, in addition to detecting evidence of this this halo around the Milky Way, is they're also hoping maybe to detect evidence of either gas clouds or planets or even stars that are made up entirely of antimatter. Now, this is something that could potentially happen. Up till now, we haven't been able to detect these things because matter and antimatter behave pretty much the same way. So a star made of matter and a star made of antimatter, by looking at the light coming off them, we wouldn't be able to tell the difference. The only way we can distinguish between the two is by detecting positrons or antimatter nuclei that are emanating from one of the sources. So that's what one of the objectives of this mission is, to try and see if we can detect any source like that.
Well, now finally the ISS will be able to do some science. I mean, up until now, the amount of science that is produced, you could fit comfortably on the back of a postage stamp. I'm a bit of an ISS skeptic. Long thought it's a gigantic waste of money. For $100 billion spent on this thing, and it really is not at all impressive, if you ask me. It's a great feat of engineering, but scientifically, it's done hardly anything.
Right. I think it has a lot of potential. I think this kind of mission is exactly what the ISS was meant for. Is these kinds of experiments that can only be done from orbit, that can be mounted to a platform that makes it easy to maintain. You have people who are there all the time. They can fix it if anything goes wrong. They can switch things on and off manually if you have to. This is what it's for. But like you said, it hasn't really done much of this up till now.
Take $10 billion off the ISS's budget, give it to some clever scientist somewhere at the JPL or whatever.
SETI.
Or SETI. And let them do a lander on Europa. I mean, it's infinitely more awesome. But anyway, so this antimatter thing is pretty cool. And let's hope there are antimatter galaxies. That would be pretty awesome if we can confirm this.
Would blow my mind if half the universe out there that we're looking at was made of antimatter. Holy crap.
I feel like an awesome sci-fi plot coming along here. We could meet aliens made out of antimatter, but we could never touch them. And maybe they're beautiful, and our hero falls in love with a beautiful maiden from this alien species, and they can never touch. It's like the Cassiopeia story.
I think that would be a short movie. As soon as we arrive, explosion.
No.
End of movie.
No.
Roll credits.
I mean, let's face it, sexual tension drives everything on TV, so it's perfect. I could storytell a little heart. An anti-horror.
The article on this detector does mention that it is somewhat controversial because it didn't go through NASA's usual peer review process, and the hypothesis that there are these antimatter galaxies is extremely controversial.
And if I'm not mistaken, it kind of goes against the called the standard model of quantum physics. There shouldn't be antimatter galaxies.
But, you know, I think the controversial bit here is not that this is being investigated, but that the government is spending $2 billion on it. But I think once in a while spending some money on ideas that are somewhat far out is probably a good idea, because if this pans out, it'll be massive. It is controversial, though, so it'll be interesting to see how this unfolds and how the scientific debate about the result proceeds. And hopefully this will challenge the standard model, because we know it's incomplete, but we don't have good data to modify it properly. So, hey, maybe this $2 billion will turn out to be well spent. We'll have to wait and see.
This is Dr. Stephen Novella from The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, but right now you're listening to Consilience.
Moving on to our feature this week, as promised, we are continuing with our big history themed 101, and Angela is going to regale us with some awesome cosmology.
Today we're going to continue our exploration of big history, the multidisciplinary study of history at the grandest scale, to quote Michael, from the Big Bang to the present. We covered the Big Bang itself in episode 6, and today we're going to discuss formation of galaxies, stars, and solar systems. After the Big Bang, the universe was almost completely homogeneous, which means it was the same everywhere. We can see from the cosmic microwave background radiation that there were fluctuations in less than one part in every 100,000. Although the universe was mostly uniform, some regions were slightly denser than others. These more dense regions became gravitationally bound to each other, and as the universe expanded and cooled, clumps of dark matter and gas began to condense within those areas. They became more massive until they reached the Jeans mass and began to collapse, forming galaxies, galaxy clusters, and superclusters. The Jeans mass is named after the British physicist Sir James Jeans, who was able to show that, under appropriate conditions, a gaseous cloud, or part of one, would become unstable and begin to collapse when it lacked sufficient gaseous pressure support to balance the force of gravity. At this point, the universe was almost exclusively composed of hydrogen, helium, and dark matter. Soon after the first proto-galaxy formed,
was dark matter.
Dark matter is matter we think exists because we can detect its gravitational effects, but we can't see it because it doesn't emit radiation in any form that we can measure. Soon after the first proto-galaxies formed, the hydrogen and helium gas within them began to condense and make the first stars. The oldest observed galaxies are more than 13 billion years old. In 2007, a team of scientists from the California Institute of Technology, using the Keck telescope in Hawaii, found 6 star-forming galaxies about 13.2 billion light-years away, and therefore created when the universe was only 500 million years old. Depending on their age and the conditions influencing their creation, galaxies are found in a variety of shapes, from featureless elliptical galaxies to graceful spiral galaxies. Edwin Hubble, a prolific American astronomer who changed our understanding of the universe in many profound ways, developed a system of classification for different galaxy types. The Hubble sequence is what it's called. This is the tuning fork diagram which divides galaxies into elliptical, spiral, and barred spiral forms. Elliptical galaxies have smooth, featureless light distributions and appear as ellipses in photographic images. For an example, you can Google M49. M is the Messier number, which is just a catalogue of galaxies and planetary names. A spiral galaxy consists of a flattened disk with stars forming a usually two-armed spiral structure and a central concentration of stars known as the bulge. Roughly half of all spirals are also observed to have a bar-like structure extending from the central bulge at the ends of which spiral arms begin. For an example, you can Google M91. At the center of the Hubble tuning fork lies an intermediate class of galaxies known as lenticulars, and given the symbol SO. These galaxies consist of a bright central bulge, similar in appearance to an elliptical galaxy, surrounded by an extended disk-like structure. Unlike spiral galaxies, the disks of lenticular galaxies have no visible spiral structure and are not actively forming stars in any significant quantity. For example, you can look up M85. Galaxies that do not fit the Hubble sequence because they have no regular structure are termed irregular galaxies, and M82 is a good example of this. Moving on from galaxies, we're going to go to the formation of stars. One of the most beautiful astronomical objects is the Great Nebula in the constellation Orion. What makes it special for me especially is that whenever I look at it, I know I'm seeing the formation of brand new stars. Stars form in a region of gas, and they are triggered by the same force which caused the formation of galaxies themselves, gravity. A star is a massive luminous ball of plasma held together by gravity. Plasma, Michael, before you ask, is a state of matter which is created by heating gas until a certain portion of the particles are ionized.
So you're saying it's a miasma of incandescent plasma?
Yes.
Oh, no.
Yes, I am. It's a miasma of incandescent. If you'd like to see plasma for yourself, you can get one of those awesome little balls that's got that's like pink and blue light, and it's full of gas, and you turn it on, and you can put your hand on it, and then the light follows your hand around as you move. That's plasma, called a plasma ball. The earliest stars were formed from collapsing clouds of hydrogen and helium. The infalling particles are smashed together in the center of the cloud of gas, and as they accrete, the core becomes dense and hot enough for nuclear fusion to ignite spontaneously. Once this happens, the star is turned on. One very important feature of these stars, and the galaxies which form in similar manner, is that the gravitational contraction causes the matter to start spinning around its central axis. The most famous example of this is the figure skater, who starts spinning in place, and by pulling her arms in close to her body, she spins faster and faster. Exactly the same principles apply to the infalling matter which creates stars and galaxies. Once the first stars had exhausted their nuclear fuel, they exploded as novae and supernovae, and seeded their home galaxies with the heavier elements which had been formed by the fusion reactions in their cores. These heavier elements became embedded within the interstellar gas clouds from which later generations of stars formed. Sometimes these stars would form in a cloud with a disk of gas and dust orbiting them. These disks are the raw material of the planets which form in a solar system. The tiny particles in the disk are drawn together by gravity. They clump into larger globs which then attract particles from further away. These globs grow larger and larger and sweep out a clean orbit around their star. After billions of years, a solar system forms and you have a sun and planets like we do here.
So in other words, we are made from corpses of previous generations of stars.
Yes.
And sometimes these materials go through multiple iterations of supernovae. So I believe our sun is a third generation star. So the matter that makes up the sun and our solar system has exploded in supernovas twice before. It probably won't do so again, but that's where you get the heavy elements like gold and iron and so on.
If you're interested in learning more about galaxies and the different types, there's a citizen science project online called Galaxy Zoo, which allows you to, as a user on the website, you go to the website and you go through a quick training course, and you can then look at pictures of galaxies that have been taken by various telescopes and classify them according to the different classification scales. And that, by doing that, you get to participate in science.
I've lost many, many hours of my life on Galaxy Zoo. You can find me. My username is Skeptic Detective.
Better than spending your time playing Zombie Lane, if you ask me.
Yes, it is a much better use of your data cap.
Well, that's all for our 101 this week, and now we move on to announcements. We have two announcements this week. The first one is coming up on the 4th of May on Wednesday, and that is Skeptics of the Pub Johannesburg. We hope to have this podcast out in time again.
we always announce these Skeptics in the Pub
on the day.
On the day that the podcast comes out. I think we should really try to make it earlier in the future.
We should have announced this one last week, but to be honest, I hadn't been on the ball in setting up the relevant events online, so blame me for that one, but hopefully we'll get this one out in time.
For future reference, Skeptics in the Pub Johannesburg is generally held on the first Wednesday of every month, and we alternate between two or three different venues.
Quite right, and this month the venue is the Brazen Head Pub in Sandton, so check that out. We'll link to the Facebook and Plancast pages, and then you can get directions and maps and that thing, and hopefully we'll see you there.
Just to reiterate ScopeX, which is the telescope exhibition, it's going to be happening Saturday the 7th of May at the War Museum in Johannesburg.
We hope to see you there too.
Yeah, we're going to try and get permission to do some interviews and a bit of recording from the site. I think that would be pretty awesome.
And weather permitting, we hope to be at the Star Party as well with our scopes.
Oh yeah. We've kind of been brainstorming some ideas for extra segments for the show, and if you have any ideas, please, you know, let us know if there's anything you'd like for us to tackle. One of the things we are going to probably start doing within the next few weeks is sort of a question and answer session. So
If you, our dear listeners, have any scientific or skepticism-related questions, please drop us an email. All of our contact details are available on the blog for the podcast, and we'll do the best we can to give you as balanced and scientific an answer as we possibly can.
Excellent.
Cool.
All right, well, that's all we have for you guys this week. Shall we sign off? Angela, where can our listeners find you on the internet?
My Twitter handle is @AngelaMeaden, and you can find me on skepticdetective.wordpress.com or email me at skepticdetective@gmail.com.
Awesome. And Michael, where can we find you?
I'm also on Twitter. My handle is @MichaelMeaden, one word. And my blog is Ionian Enchantment, and that's hosted on Blogger. Just Google Ionian Enchantment and you'll find it.
We'll link to it in the show notes as well.
Yeah, and you can email me at michael.meaden@gmail.com. Oh, and where can we find you?
Well, I'm all over the internet, but...
Oh, God.
I tried to link all of my stuff back to my personal landing page, which you can find at owenswart.org. You should be able to find everything you need there. Thanks to my co-hosts and to you, the listeners. Be sure to join us again next week for more Consilience.
It's been awesome.
Bye.
You have been listening to Consilience. Our website is consiliencecast.wordpress.com, and you can send us an email to consiliencecast@gmail.com. Theme music is The Optimist by Zoe Keating from freemusicarchive.org.
Anyway, the earliest stars were formed...
Angela suggesting you play with balls.
Michael!